It's The Wonky Show. We're talking about demand and demographics, speculating about next week's budget, reviewing data on international students' perception of the UK, and good news, everyone, someone's published a university wish list. It's all coming up.
And, you know, we've seen the last 10 years, there haven't been major increases in the pay settlements nationally that have been negotiated. Senior pay ought to reflect that as well, and we ought to exercise constraint.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Leach, and joining me to discuss the size and shape of HE policy this week, as usual, we have three fantastic guests. In Glasgow, it's David Duncan, Chief Operating Officer and University Secretary at the University of Glasgow. David, your highlight of the week, please.
Highlight of the week, I think, was signing a contract for a new building on campus, £300 million investment, mainly in computer science and engineering, a major step forward, I think, in our learning and teaching provision on campus. So really delighted to get that across the line.
Lovely. And in East London, it's Selina Bolingbroke, Principal at the Building Crafts College. Selina, your highlight of the week.
Well, I was reminded this week we attended the opening of a new entrance to Stratford Station because some of our talented crafts students had made the benches in the entrance. But what I was reminded of was that it was 10 years in the making to do an opening. And I think given some of the things that are going to come up in this week's podcast, just a reminder of how long even what you'd think was relatively simple infrastructure takes to get built.
And Oxford, it's Michael Salmon, Wonky's news editor. Michael, your highlight of the week, please.
Morning, Mark. Morning, everyone. We had a classic Wonky drinks event trip to the pub yesterday, and I met a lot of people from across the sector who I've exchanged about a billion emails with over the last few years, but have never actually met in person. So that was lovely.
Indeed. We're all paying for it today. Right. We start the week with a big new report about student demand and decline. Michael, you'll run us through it, please.
Yes. So this is a report from the Higher Education Policy Institute, or HEPI, as I think we'll all be saying quite a lot in the next sort of 10 minutes. And it's from its president. It's from the HEPI president, Bahram Bekradnia. And it's about, or at least in headline terms, it's about student demand for higher education in England. Sadly, they didn't look at the whole UK up to the year 2035, which I think is a very kind of timely thing to be thinking about, because we've, over the last sort of few years, we've had quite a lot of people looking at, you know, this decade we're in now up to 2030, where student numbers have always been forecast over this period to rise, simply because there are more 18-year-olds in the UK, in England, and it's not the case in all of the UK, but there is a forecast rise in demographics due to sort of, you know, when people have had their babies, that filtering through now. Okay, but this is look, and it's always been known, or it's been known since the last time the Office for National Statistics had a look at this, that this wouldn't continue forever. You know, the population, we do have a falling sort of population if it's not for migration in the UK. And in the 2030s, the number of 18-year-olds is set to decline throughout the decade, essentially, you know, with the odd little wobble, and we'll see what actually happens. But, I think it's pretty established this will happen. And so it's always been a question, okay, what does that mean for the number of people in university? Is because it's sort of the case in the 2010s as well. The numbers have been demographically declining, but because entry rates to university have been going up, it's sort of not really hit the sector. And this report is looking at, is suggesting that it is going to potentially be a problem in the 2030s, because it argues there's been a sort of plateauing of demand in the last 2 years, which, you know, I think is maybe a little bit early to say that. Obviously, we're post-pandemic. You know, we did actually have more accepted students this year, but we had them than we were expecting. But it's true that application numbers as a whole have sort of, you know, not hit the peaks that some forecast in the past. And the report is really saying, you know, this is a problem. We need to start thinking about it. There's all kinds of issues if student numbers fall, and the system as it stands, you know, as it's been sort of shaped over the last decade, isn't really set up to deal with student numbers falling in terms of the impacts for different institutions, especially.
Right. Yes. Lots here. And let's start with that impact on different institutions. I mean, one of the things that Barham suggests is some kind of system of student number controls are going to be needed to stop, because we've seen in that period, we've seen big Russell Group universities being able to hoover up numbers at the expense of others. And that's created a lot of volatility in the system, hasn't it? So there's a call in this for some way of managing the market, which is fascinating to me because previously that was a no-go area on HEPI. But it's you know, one thing does follow from the other. I mean, David, you know, obviously there is a system of managing the market in Scotland because the system is quite different. But you know, clearly that's going to prove controversial, isn't it?
Well, yes, I think it would be if that were reintroduced in England. In Scotland, there are a couple of differences. One is that the demographics are slightly different. I think we haven't seen the rising numbers of school leavers, I think, through the 2020s that the English market has seen. So in a way, we've hit the problem a bit earlier than England. And secondly, as you say, we have number controls in Scotland. Those don't necessarily provide salvation for universities that struggle in the marketplace to compete against stronger competitors. Basically, if a student doesn't want to go to a particular university, it doesn't necessarily, if they desire to go to one university, it doesn't necessarily mean they'll go to another university just because they can't get into the first one. So what we see in Scotland is that quite a few universities simply don't meet the targets that are set. So we have number controls, but they're not necessarily being applied in the way that you might expect. So I'm not sure that will be a salvation for England if things pan out the way that's predicted.
Mm. I mean, Selina, there's sort of good news in all this, isn't there? Because, I mean, this report looked at the last 2 years, but not the year just gone. And some of these trends started to go back in reverse again in terms of demand last year. So is there hope?
I don't think that there is reason to panic, but I think what this report does do very helpfully is to prod us into more detailed scenario planning as a sector. I think one of the things with the sector that is, as you say, quite significant in terms of the way in which market-led demand has stood up despite some really quite severe challenges over the last few years. I think the popularity of HE has perhaps surprised people given the rising costs of HE over the same period. And I don't just mean fees. Obviously, I mean the cost of living from a student perspective, that despite those challenges, demand has held up pretty well. But I think the other thing with HE is, to some extent, it has always reflected what alternatives there are for, it's not really just 18-year-olds, is it? Because actually you start planning for HE probably, you know, certainly by year 9, year 10. So it's what options young people perceive that they have at an earlier age. And I think we will see, hopefully over the next 6 months, starting with the budget in a couple of weeks, what the new government is planning in terms of things like the course provision in the FE sector and apprenticeships and so on. It will also to some extent reflect the economy and the employment market for young people. I think university demand can't be seen in isolation from the other options that young people will have. But if I could just say this about the planning side of it, because I think the other thing with a new government is, to what extent will the OFS as regulator engage in some of the leadership around planning? It's been a long time since we have had a body that has had formal responsibility for HE planning in this way. And I do wonder if that might also become a more acute part of a refreshed OFS under a new government. I certainly think that would be desirable, not necessarily, you know, to rush into student number controls. But I do think the premise that is made in the HEPI report is that it would be very short-term thinking if we were to lose individual providers, given what we know about the value of a place-based approach to university provision.
It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because trying to balance these, I mean, as you were talking, Selina, I heard 1,000 finance directors cringing at the idea of OFS student number controls and, you know, the kind of enormous bureaucracy that would have to emerge to do that. On the other hand, nobody wants any universities to fail, and, you know, there's obviously, you know, a whole system reasons why that would be very bad for, you know, for the whole sector. So trying to balance these things, obviously difficult. I mean, Michael, DK made the interesting point. I mean, this builds on what Selina's saying. It's kind of a choice, isn't it, what this government wants from higher education, the size and the shape of it. A legitimate door to open might be to say, yeah, we do want a kind of big expanded Russell Group, and that's where all the, you know, the numbers are going to pour into, and, you know, that's if the market wants that. And and we'll let, you know, smaller providers kind of wither away. It's unlikely they're going to say that, but, you know, they could. And you could say, well, you know, the sector's lining up that way and go with the flow. But they haven't yet set out what they want from the sector and how they want to balance it and where, you know, who should go where and do what. I mean, as much as they are going to have a view about that, there needs to be some kind of strategic understanding of how the sector is organized and how it contributes to the economy and emissions and everything else, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. Like you say, it's a big size and shape question. And this paper, although it is looking really at the demographics of 18-year-olds in England only, you know, I can't help think underlying it, there's a much bigger question. You know, lots of these issues with, you know, falling home student recruitment by lower and medium tariff institutions and, you know, the relative growth of, you know, how much higher tariff institutions are recruiting home students. A big part of that, exactly as you say, DK has gone through this in a lot of detail and with some lovely charts on the site, is about the decline in mature students and non, you know, the not 18-year-old part of HE. And we're still waiting to hear from Labour what their feelings are about that. You know, I do sort of see a lot of it not as about what's going on in 2030, but what's just happened in the summer now. You know, what does this all mean for, you know, this sort of competition where we sort of see to some extent some poaching of students or some sort of, you know, the kind of softening in entry requirements in certain places and in certain courses that allows higher tariff universities to recruit somewhat more aggressively. It felt like that was kind of the impetus for writing this report. I mean, I may be just sort of reading too much into it, but it, you know, it felt to me like a lot of it was about really, you know, what's going on right now, not necessarily what's going on in 2030. But it's true that all the problems will just get more acute.
Yeah, yeah. David, I mean, the report's about England only, but I mean, what else, you know, what else could we learn from the Scottish experience if you're ahead of us in terms of demographics and you're already living in a controlled system? You know, what are the arguments we need to be getting in now to make that overall work better for the whole sector when it lands for us?
Well, I suppose the key message is to beware of unintended consequences. What you think might be a way to control and manage the system and control the market quite often has consequences that you haven't envisaged. And I don't think the answer to England's problems and the possibility of some institutions struggling in the marketplace is number controls. The answer obviously is increased funding of one sort or another for HE across the board. And that's the same in Scotland. The number controls thing, I think, is probably going to be an irrelevance.
Right. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Charlene Pullen, Principal Research Fellow at Sheffield Hallam University, and this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about degree apprenticeships and widening participation. Our research with the Edge Foundation involves speaking to two universities about the role that they have in recruiting degree apprentices, particularly outreach and employer engagement. Since degree apprenticeships are first and foremost a job with training, universities can only really influence employer recruitment decisions. In different sectors, there seem to be different recruitment patterns. For example, in health, degree apprentices tend to be existing staff who might have been considered widening participation candidates in the past, while in sectors like digital, employers often look for new recruits in their degree apprentices who might be more likely to stay at the organisation for a longer period. Finally, we found that outreach teams at these two post-92 institutions that we interviewed to staff are increasingly asked to cover degree apprenticeships, but often mostly at higher retaining schools.
Now, it's in the weird run-up to the budget, that strange period we get every now and again. Selena, read the runes for us.
So, we are a week out from budget day. There has been a fair amount of coverage in the press this week about, various sector bodies' submissions to the Treasury, but in particular, UUK's submission to the Treasury, which, amongst other things, is warning about the impact of the costs of association to the Horizon Europe programme having to be tucked into the existing research project. It's one of those issues that has been said to be under consideration. And clearly, this was not something that people in the research community were expecting, given that there is £1 billion of cost associated with Horizon Europe. So if it is met, get out of the standing pot, then clearly that's going to cause lots of cuts elsewhere in terms of displacement. And that seems to have been one of those last minute unexpected kind of googly balls that has got thrown in. I think the other thing as well is that universities, not just universities, colleges, probably many public sector employers, but in particular, universities are concerned about employer NI. And if that goes up, what that will do to their staffing bills. And indeed, if that gets charged on pensions, which is another idea that has been mooted. So there's a number of warnings, I think, that have been set out by sector representatives to both DfE, the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology, and the Treasury. And there are also some asks. Whether or not the warnings are heeded and whether or not the asks are met, we shall have to wait and see.
Sorry, Michael, there's obviously concerns about research, but there's a sort of degree of optimism about teaching and fees and all of that, right?
Yes. I mean, optimism in the sense that, well, certainly in September, we heard quite a lot of sort of briefing that, you know, eight different approaches to HE funding in England were being modelled by the Treasury. Maintenance was sort of, you know, there was a kind of ongoing discussion between DfE and Treasury to get student maintenance rises in. And it felt like it was sort of being geared up for the budget. You know, obviously we need to know these things sort of just logistically and legally. You know, what are the tuition fee levels for next September? What are the student maintenance levels? I think they need to be announced by January. But it sort of felt like it was kind of in progress and discussions were ongoing and would hear things by the budget. I feel like there's been much less rumoured of that, which, as you said to me in the pub last night, could well mean that that's because it's now actually happening. And it's, you know, the rumoured stuff is the stuff that's still being sort of argued about. But I'm not sure whether we should expect that in the budget, but it's certainly, you know, there's news on fees and finance coming quite soon.
Well, I mean, I suppose when the new UK government came in, there were positives in the sense that there was a more sort of positive tone about higher education nationally, but also kind of a dearth of policies, really. We weren't sure what the government really intended to do with higher education. And there seemed to be two concerns coming up. One is, you know, will they address that? Will they cut the amount of funding that goes directly to HE? People are talking about maybe £1 billion cut off the UKRI budget, which I think would be disastrous. And at the same time, you know, are there possible consequences of other changes, as Selena said, things around NI, for example? I mean, both of those could be pretty damaging to the sector. You know, there are a lot of universities across the UK that are already struggling with deficit budgets, and we don't want to see that made worse. But also, if research funding is cut, and that would directly affect Scottish universities as well as English ones and ones in the other devolved nations, then, you know, our international reputation pretty well is based on our research power. And if that research power is adversely affected by cuts in research funding, then we will struggle also to recruit international students as well. So there could be some real negatives coming out of next week's budget, but there could also be some positives. We'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, and I mean, the other sort of from a policy sort of research policy side of things is it then becomes very interesting. If there is a cut in the UKRI budget for, you know, this, we're just talking about the next year and we're not at the multi-year spending review stage yet. But if there is a cut in the budget, okay, what does that actually mean? How does that get distributed? We will get into a subsequent phase if this is announced, that is then, okay, what gets cut? Is it certain things to do with QR? Is it about new grants? Is it things, you know, where does that fall? And there will be a furious sort of second round of lobbying, not at the government, but at UKRI, where everybody needs to sort of set out to them why, you know, why certain things should remain and why certain things need to be prioritised. Obviously, it's, you know, it's very damaging for the UK research environment if these cuts do come about. But it's also, it is an interesting opportunity for some conversations, just, you know, with my kind of policy wonk hat on. Hopefully that doesn't sound too cynical, but, you know, that next phase could be very key about, okay, how does that get spread out across the sector?
Mm. And it may only be a kind of interim settlement, right, until the spending review runs its course. So, yeah. So this is the start of a process, not kind of the final story. And I would also expect on that question of fees, if we do get some movement, definitely something on maintenance, we think, and possibly something on fees, maybe wishful thinking, but possibly something on fees, then that's only going to be probably what, until 2026, 27, And there's going to have to be a bigger question as to, you know, what comes after that, because, you know, the ministers have said they're not happy with the system as it is and how it's designed. So, you know, you could also imagine a scenario where they announce a review of it all alongside that kind of spending period, can't you?
Can I just sort of say, I think the thing that struck me sort of thinking about this, looking across those different sector groups that have been putting in their letters of warning and asks over the last few weeks is, I mean, certainly a reset of both the individual student finance system as well as the university funding system appears pretty much on everybody's list. But the other thing that struck me as you look across them is how there's quite a lot of workforce related asks amongst those sector bodies. So whether it be, you know, teacher training or healthcare worker education, which is what the University Alliance have mentioned, certainly at the sort of feeder end to the HE sector, you know, from the Association of Colleges, it's very much around lecturer pay parity with teachers. But it just struck me that there's quite a lot of quite sort of technical, arguably internally facing asks there. And I think what will be really critical for the sector is about, as you say, the long-term spending review, but also some of the big key policy pieces that we've been promised by the new government, such as the industrial strategy and how the government sees universities fitting into that and what kind of funding becomes available because of that. I think the other thing that I've seen that I think, you know, certainly attractive at some levels, and it's not the first time that this has been proposed from a policy perspective, but I think it was the House of Lords Industry and Regulators Committee. They proposed a skills tax relief, which I think actually could be very impactful for the sector, because that would essentially allow employers to get some form of tax credit against the cost of employee training. And one of the things that we were talking about when we were looking at the HEPI report on demographics is actually, although that report concentrates on the 18-year-old entrant, one of the things that has completely fallen off over the last 10 to 15 years is adults and mature students enrolled within higher education. So maybe there will be some shorter term, but some, you know, slightly left field proposals that come out. Because I think, as you say, Mark, it would be very difficult in this sort of 1 year stage and without, you know, in the absence of a full HE review, which is what we're expecting, to make any significant changes to the wider funding system.
Is it worth adding? I mean, I think that the sector needs to be careful in this period. Obviously, everybody puts in their asks before budget day, and that's fair enough. But we have to be careful that we don't just say two things to government, as we generally do. One of being, we want more money and we want less regulation. We need to think also about what the sector can do for the government's agenda. And if that focuses on things like social mobility and the contribution that we make to the economy, we need to big that up and make that clear, not just to government, but to the public as a whole. And perhaps those messages aren't coming through strongly enough at the moment.
I think David is absolutely right there. And I think I'm not so sure whether or not the government's priority is social mobility. I mean, I think it's a byproduct, but I think the two things that are going to come through most clearly is the investment that they clearly want to make in both health and housing, and how the sector relates to that and is part of the delivery, I think, is a message that should have been landed, but I'm not clear that it has, certainly from a kind of, you know, the public's perception.
Now, IDP's Emerging Futures report is out. David, walk us through that, please.
Okay, thanks. So this is a report from IDP Connect. It's their sixth report, and it explores international student perceptions of different destinations. It's quite a significant piece of work. They've gone to about 6,000 people across 114 countries to get their views on you know, being an international student. And I think what we've seen is a difference in interest in different markets across the UK. Canada, I think, has seen a big drop in the percentage of students wanting to go there for various reasons, largely down to caps on numbers. United States is up a little bit, and the UK has largely held its position despite some worries about the impact of government policy. Not sure what's happening in Australia. But I think the two things that are coming through quite strongly from students, first of all, is a concern about post-study work visas, maybe more for some markets than others, but that's an enduring concern. People do want to work in the countries they study in after they've completed their degrees. And then secondly, cost. Not surprisingly, people are concerned about visa costs, about associated costs, living costs, and of course, tuition fee costs.
I think for us in the UK, obviously we've seen some challenges in the international student recruitment market this year. But I think there's still a lot of good news. I think the more positive tone about international students coming from the new UK government is a good thing. And certainly in Scotland, we've got a new international strategy coming out, a new migration advisory service. These sorts of things, I think, will help international student recruitment. Other countries, as we've seen, Canada and others, perhaps becoming less welcoming to international students. We've still got a very strong UK presence in the world's top 100, particularly the QS rankings with 15 UK universities in there. The economy might not have grown that much recently, but there are still plenty of employment opportunities in the UK, and inflation seems to be dropping. And then UK universities are still very competitive in terms of student experience and recruitment. So I think there's a lot to be positive about looking forward, even although there are some challenges, as this report highlights.
Michael, what is going on in Canada and Australia?
Yeah, I mean, so this is the thing, right? So if you're just, as Wonky tends to do, you know, we typically have, we're you know, UK higher education organization. We're looking at international student policy here week in, week out, especially under the Tories. You know, that was the main part of my job, was like, what's the Home Office doing this week? It feels like, you know, international student policy in the UK has been sort of in turmoil, we're sort of projecting an unwelcoming attitude. There have been concrete policy changes around dependent visas particularly, but other ones as well. And there's this whole sort of, you know, shenanigans with the graduate routes that in the end came to naught, but did very little for the reputation. Right. But given all that, you know, the UK is sort of holding its position in the kind of international market because Canada and Australia, which are probably our main competitors, you know, most sort of similar offers, have in the last year they've both introduced new policies. Australia's haven't quite kicked in, but they are kicking in from January, and Canada is already now into its second year. It's just recently announced a second year of caps on numbers. So in both those countries, they're making, you know, concerted government effort to reduce international student numbers. I would also add, the big difference in both is that in both the FE sector, or, you know, whatever they call it there, the non-university sector of post-compulsory, has always traditionally, and especially in recent years, been a real contributor to student visas in a way that's just not the case in the UK. So a lot of the pain in Australia and in Canada is falling on non-universities, but also universities are being sort of caught up in it as well. You know, so for all those reasons, you could say that whatever the government has done here and whatever the new government's rhetoric is, the actual really important thing for a lot of international students is, you know, compared to other countries, how does the UK look? And I'll just add also on this, in this report, there's a real narrative that more and more we're seeing students are very flexible about their destinations. I mean, it feels to me that that's sort of been the case for quite a while, but IDP Connect is stressing this is even more so. You know, students are applying to lots of different countries, you know, getting offers and then making a decision quite late, and they're very, you know, elastic in their demand, and the policies that the government introduces can have a big effect on whether they suddenly change their minds and decide to go to New Zealand or Ireland or, you know, the USA, maybe, you know, Trump dependent, for the next year.
Right, good news, everyone. There's a university wish list that's been published. Michael, tell us about it.
Yeah, so this is from everyone's favourite opaquely funded lobby group, the Taxpayers Alliance, which have, you know, they've got this lovely sort of conveniently vague name that means we don't really know who they are, and we certainly don't know who's funding them. They spend a lot of time looking at sort of public sector pay, council pay. They get on the radio, they get in the Telegraph, they get in the Mail, and they say that people in the public sector and, you know, are being paid too much. Is that especially their sort of main thing, or, you know, taxes shouldn't go up is another, you know, sort of bugbear. And they've turned their attention back to higher education this week. They did a report a few years ago. They've come back, they've sent out some FOIs, and they've looked at the HESA data from you know, more than a year ago, because we don't have anything more recent. Just to sort of do a bit of muckraking about senior staff pay in higher education. It's not just VC pay this time. They're looking at everybody earning more than £100,000. And they've done a sort of, you know, it's sort of interesting in a way that they've clearly sort of thought, okay, we can't just say people are paid, you know, £120,000 or whatever. It's not really going to sort of, you know, get people dropping their marmalade. But so they've done a bit more about like looking at pay per student numbers, or pay compared to a university's league table position, or pay compared to graduate salaries. It's kind of got like a sort of spurious veneer of depth. But, you know, I think probably when it comes to individual institutions, it's kind of methodology methodologically a bit rubbish. But you know, there is a wider discussion to be had about sort of trends across the sector. They, as they point out, you know, pay as a whole has been rising for a decade. There's, or you know, more specifically, there's more people paid higher salaries in the sector, quite a lot more than there were a decade ago. You know, and it is true that this is this remains an incredibly sore point with many academic and professional services staff, despite all the sort of arguments out there about comparing universities to companies and things like that.
So this is obviously an issue that hasn't gone away just because of the change of government, because as you're saying, Michael, the dark money think tanks and the Telegraph and the Daily Mail and such are going to continue to write stories about this. But I mean, where is the, David, maybe help us find the kind of the grain of the truth or the kernel of the nugget of the thing in the thing about what, why people, might be concerned about senior pay in universities.
Well, this is a story that never really goes away. And organizations like the Taxpayers Alliance keep highlighting it. But, I don't think we can just dismiss it. I think we have to accept that there is a legitimate concern within university communities and across the wider public about differentials in pay. I mean, if you go to a country like Sweden, the difference in pay between, a sweeper or, a facilities assistant and the head of an institution is much narrower than it is in the UK. If you go to the States, you'll find it is much wider than it is in the UK. So it doesn't have to be the way that it is. There will always be a concern about high pay of senior people. And I think it's right that senior management and governing bodies across the sector should be sensitive to that and avoid significant rises in senior pay, particularly at a time of pay restraint. And, we've seen the last 10 years, there haven't been major increases in the pay settlements nationally that have been negotiated. Senior pay ought to reflect that as well, and we ought to exercise constraint.
Well, Selina, it's quite a different picture in the sector you're in now, right?
Yes, it is a different picture. But I think just to say, if we loop back to the discussion we were having about the budget and the narrative that universities are being framed in from both a kind of a government policy perspective, but also kind of voters, the public's perception, the fact that this story won't go away is never helpful, is it? In terms of universities persuading against competing demands that they are worthy of investment. So I think we all know that if you took out every single person who is earning above £100,000 in the sector, it ain't going to solve the sector's funding crisis. The one doesn't equal the other. But I think that David is right. It's not something that can be ignored. And as Michael says, the way in which the data has been pulled together, I think it is a little clumsy in its manipulation. However, my kind of reading of it was, it does appear incredibly random. The sums that are paid in relation to the size and challenges of different universities, there is not a kind of a linear relationship between necessarily senior pay and the turnover of an institution or the number of students or the prestige of an institution. So I think there is something there for the sector to think about. But I would also sort of throw in there that over the last sort of 10 to 15 years, in many ways, the job of being a senior manager within a university has become more complex. I think many institutions recruit outside of the sector to help them manage some of those complexities. And in that sense, it's not just reflecting a progression, if you like, from the academic or professional service space. It is having to reflect the fact that in some parts, universities have very complex estates issues and therefore need to bring in people from outside and therefore are competing with all sorts of different organisations. I mean, I think the problems in recruiting people, particularly around the finance and the estates briefs, has been an issue in the sector for a while. So pay is one way of solving that problem. But I think the point here is that we have to find a, I don't think we've cut through this. It is still going to be there. And we have an uncomfortable moment at least once a year when, if it's not the Taxpayers Alliance, as you say, it is somebody else who can see some fairly sensational headlines. But it's not just your Daily Mail readers. It is something that is used as a point of very real concern and frustration with trade unions opinions within the sector as well.
Yeah, yeah, and for all those reasons, it's not gonna go away, and it is a legitimate topic of conversation, isn't it? Even if Michael, the way it's reported in the Daily Mail is often quite sensationalist, but it has, you know, the heat of it has been taken out, hasn't it? Because the government isn't amplifying this particularly. There were fewer kind of voices on the stage turning this into kind of a big media event as we've seen in the last few years.
Exactly. That's the point. It is, you know, it's interesting that this is still in the papers, but, you know, it, increasingly what's in some of the right-wing papers is sort of becoming a bit detached from reality as they sort of scrabble around to maintain their relevance with the new government. I mean, the important thing to note here, as you say, is that this isn't accompanied by a quote from the HE minister. It's not coming up in PMQs. And it's also not something, say, in England that the Office for Students is sort of harping on about as much as it used to. It hasn't done an analysis, you know, an actual commentary on senior staff pay for a little while. And yeah, certainly the Department for Education under Labour has, that I'm aware of, never commented in any way since coming to power on university staff pay or vice chancellor pay. So it is interesting that we're in a slightly different landscape at the moment. I wonder to what extent it could come around again when Labour begins to actually sort of intervene, when it's publicly seen to be supporting universities. I mean, I think part of the sort of jockeying among some of the, you know, the papers and the think tanks is to sort of, you know, try and get out ahead and make the case that the government shouldn't be giving more money to universities, isn't it, really, is sort of their agenda there.
Can I just add, I mean, quite often in these articles, you'll see the phrase as a kind of justification that vice chancellors' pay packages or senior managers' pay packages are benchmarked against the sector. And my experience of looking at a whole variety of different governing bodies over the last few years is generally, this may not be reported, but governing bodies increasingly will benchmark in relation to their own staff pay rates and to look at the multiples in relation to the lowest paid members of staff and the highest paid members of staff. And I think that is something that is to be welcomed. I think that is part of good governance. But I think that's not what we see cutting through in terms of the messaging around this. So maybe, you know, we need to be, or our representative bodies need to be more aggressive at sort of pushing out information about the kind of considerations and the way in which these decisions are made.
It's certainly true that remuneration committees in universities have become much more sophisticated at comparing differentials within their own staff complement from the highest to the lowest, and also comparing their own pay against other, you know, related sized universities. And so I think good practice within remuneration committees has improved enormously. But, you know, the issue of pay differentials will still come up. It comes up regularly in the national pay negotiations, understandably. And, you know, we've seen a rise in the lowest pay, partly because of the national living wage, the government's intervention, but also the adherence to the voluntary living wage. So the lowest paid in the universities have lowest pay levels have increased quite considerably in the past 5 or so years. But, you know, there is a squeeze middle because of constraints on pay settlements, and the issue of how they relate to the highest levels of pay in universities still gets raised on a regular basis.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go deep in anything we discuss today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to David, Selena and Michael. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.